I'll call the Environment Policy and Oversight Committee to order for March 17th. And we do have a quorum now, and in the future, if members can get here a little more quickly, we can start a little more quickly with the quorum. But we are going to be hearing a couple of bills today, and before we do so, however, we're going to approve the March 12th minutes. And let's see, Representative Loon, would you like to move the minutes, please?
I'd be happy to, Mr. Chairman. I move that the minutes be approved.
Thank you. Representative Loon moves the minutes for March 12th. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails, and minutes are adopted. We are going to be hearing, first of all, a bill from Representative Poppy, sewage treatment systems modification. And okay. Just a reminder for people in the audience, in case you are here to hear Representative Lilly's bill, that has been postponed, so we will not be hearing that until next Tuesday. The plan to hear that bill. Okay. So, Representative Poppy, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm happy to be here. I'm here to talk about House File 1275. Okay. So, and, again, I'll just get started. And,
sure, and I will move House File 1275. Be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. So, Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I am here to talk about House File 1275, but what I will really do is turn it over to Gretchen Sable, who is from the MPCA, and she will discuss the bill and be able to go through the details of what the changes are. And I believe we also have an amendment that we'll want to have put onto the bill, so if we can have that moved as well.
Sure. I will move the A09-0142 amendment.
Yes, sir.
All those in favor of the amendment? Representative McNamara.
Mr. Chair, just because there seems to be fairly... Can somebody just describe what the amendment actually does?
Okay, Representative Poppy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will turn that over to Ms. Sable. And
okay. Welcome, Ms. Sable. If you could state your name for the table.
My name is Gretchen Sable. I work for the Pollution Control Agency in the Septic System Program. The amendment is a series of changes that I had thought we could discuss in the context of the bill. Basically, there are amendments that came up after the bill was drafted and sent to the governor's office for the okay as a departmental bill. And they make changes to address issues from the on-site contractors, from the advisory committee, and the Department of Labor and Industry.
Okay. Representative McNamara.
Mr. Chair, I didn't realize it was just to get the bill in the case the author wants it.
That's correct.
I thought it was a different amendment.
Nope, there will be a different amendment coming later, but so I will move the amendment and renew the motion to pass the amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails, and amendment is adopted. So to the bill as amended.
Okay.
Ms. Sable.
Thank you very much. The statutes that relate to septic systems were first drafted in 1994, and I think they've been changed every year since, and not always changed in ways consistent within the statute, and other things have changed in the industry practice. So we sought a bill to clean up the statute, to change terminology, to bring terminology more in line with current practice, to get rid of old dates and old provisions that have passed. And so basically it's a series of technical amendments to this bill with a few additional items. Looking down the list then, starting on page one, we also provided a fact sheet that gives a summary of all this, but I'll be speaking directly from the bill. You'll see that every place that said individual, we have changed individual to subsurface. This is because septic systems have gotten bigger since 1994. They now include clusters and larger systems. They're no longer just a single individual home. The statute had always included a cluster of systems in the definition of individual, but that kind of seemed to be counterintuitive, and so we are seeking this change. When we did our rule change, we did change our rules title from individual to subsurface. On page 2 at line 2.3, you see that we're adding some new categories of professionals to the cadre of people that do the work, service providers, and we changed pumpers to a more professional sounding title of maintainer. Line 2.7, adding closure because there's been some issues with improperly closed systems once the home is connected to city sewer. We've had people, you know, might fall in tanks, those kinds of issues. So generally, the changes, we add the definition of maintainer, pumper has changed to maintainer, and some additional changes there at line 2.2. When we look at the next provision there, subdivision 2, it starts on line 3.1. The only change that we're recommending to the, requesting to the local ordinance part is the individual, the subsurface, maintain the rest of that the same. Looking at the part about the directed us to do rules, we would take out a piece of no longer needed language about warranty systems. This was back in 1997, a concept of warranty systems, which we'll be talking about a bit later, came into the statute. When we had agency budget cuts in 2000, we sought to reduce the workload that we had, and so that part was taken out of the statute. Additional money came later, and the statute was reinstated, and so this was the piece that made the bridge between the two. That's no longer needed now. At line 4.3, we have a past date. We remed that date, so we no longer need that date to comply with that. Section 4 is the piece that requires people to follow the rules, and it's just, again, terminology changes. We have some changes in the inspection language that are not truly substantive. The one that may be more on the substantive side is at 4.15, where we're going to no longer allow people to do video or electronic evidence of, they'd have to go out and do a physical inspection. That's consistent with electrical inspections and plumbing inspections and others. So I don't think that's substantive, but it's a little bit more so than just the terminology changes. Further changes are just to clarify who can do the work, a licensed inspection business or certified local unit of government at line 4.22. The agency certifies individuals and we license businesses, and so we're trying to make that split. You'll see that later within the statutory language. There is a series of provisions that were amendments to the bill looking at winter inspections, and so we're just, instead of it's line 4.23, the section starts, a local unit of government may temporarily waive the inspection requirement. What this piece of statute used to do said that you had to have your system in compliance before you could add a bedroom. We're changing that. You have to have an inspection before you add a bedroom. That gives the homeowner more flexibility in when they do the actual work. So that just brings those things in line. Again, more licensed inspection business at 5.5. Some wording changes at 5.24 just brings the date forward from the later part of the statute. Section 7, the compliance notice. We had a piece in this that was kind of difficult to administer. The B section, you see, we're requesting to be deleted. What that did was it gave people 5 years to comply with bringing their system into compliance. What we're saying now, because of the previous changes in the inspection part, they would do an inspection, they would find non-compliance, it would have to be upgraded within the time period the local government allows, so it still has to be upgraded. It's just a little differently structured there and easier for local governments to administer. In the Section 8, this is the piece that relates to the disclosure at the time a home is purchased, and we have worked with the Minnesota Association of Realtors on this language. It's somewhat of a rewording for clarity, but it also adds a provision that if there is an inspection report that has to be submitted to the buyer, so the buyer has an actual physical form that says it doesn't require the inspection, but if the inspection occurred, they would have to transfer that. Section 9 is the warranty systems piece. The warranty systems were added to the statute in 1997 as a way to allow manufacturers to sell their products without state approval. It's basically a listing process that we did And like I said before, that went away in 2000. It came back in 2001. It was amended subsequently. And in 2003, we actually got additional funds, and part of what we were supposed to do was develop a process, an administrative process for new technology. That piece is now in our rules, and we're running products through that process. So we now have an administrative process that takes the place of this warrantied statute, and it was our advisory committee that suggested that we include the sunset provision that you see there at line 9.1. The date of this sunset provision then ties back to the date of our full implementation of our rule with that product registration. So that's what that piece is. Otherwise, we're changing the word professionals in a couple places to individuals and businesses for clarity and to make enforcement more clear. In section 11, down at subpoint 9.2, line 9.21, last year the statute was changed to limit the ISCS license, to systems of 10,000 gallons per day or less, and it actually leaves out certain kinds of systems. There's concerns with if you have a number of small systems on a single lot, not individual systems, say, but clusters. And what we were seeing was a development would come in with 9,842 and 9,647, and their total was certainly more than the 10,000, but because they weren't individual, they weren't one system, they didn't require our permit. So our rule now requires that if they're within a half mile under common ownership, that they would also have to obtain our permit. And so that was why we were seeking this piece of change here, to tie it back to that requirement for a permit and not just the gallon limit. So again, that won't relate to many systems, but it would relate to some. At line 9.29 is one of the more substantive changes, where we talk about, this is the section that says a license is required for everybody except for the people listed in B that starts at 9.23. And at 9.27, it says an individual who constructs a system on their own land or land that was leased by them and functions solely as their dwelling or seasonal dwelling. We would seek to add unless specifically disallowed in local ordinance, because there have been local governments that said to us it's been a problem regulating homeowner installs, and they would prefer to be able to not allow that. And so this would give them, the local government, the authority to allow it, not on an individual basis, but by ordinance. And then the rest of the language there is moving up from later in that piece of statute. Those are things that were added to the statute to modify when that person can do that work. And you see that struck down at 10.8. One of the big pieces in the bill, then, is now that you're clearly sure that this is a boring bill, there is something that's a little bit more interesting. And this is at 10.19, starts that addition there, and also the bond may be a joint bond. So what we're trying to do, the plumbing program with the Department of Labor and Industry covers the plumbing within the house and the pipe that leads to the tank. And for to connect that tank, the SSPS guys also had to have a plumbing license or a limited plumbing certification. And so we want to allow a joint bond to save them some money on the bonding, so they only could buy this one joint bond, and that would cover both purposes. And part of the amendment does address that, so I'll get to that in a minute. But anyhow, so that's one of the big deal pieces. It actually does bring us more closely to a joint bond. We're striking obsolete language in the next couple of big changes there at 10.23, 10.29. And then when we get out to the enforcement section, again, we're moving to, again, the licensing of businesses and certifying of individuals, and adding at 11.15, failure to resolve an enforcement action would also result in loss of licensure. Our attorneys have advised us that we didn't have a real clear path, that somebody didn't have all their, if they had outstanding enforcement actions, it wasn't necessarily clear that we were not able to not renew their license if they'd otherwise met the licensing requirements, and this would allow us to not renew their license if they weren't clear. So, Looking then at the amendments, the first amendment, so line 1.2 in the amendment, we're going to insert certification so it's clear that the licensing and certification are both covered by the statute. Line 1.3 relates to page line 922, and this was language that was recently negotiated with the Minnesota On-Site Wastewater Association, who are here to talk to this bill. They were concerned that language added last year didn't fully address the issue with the relationship between septic licensing and engineering for licensing under 326. So this piece was added then to the statute. Licensees who design systems using the prescriptive designs and design guidances are not subject to the 326 statute. So I think that is pretty clear. Another change of individual to professional. Delete everything. Oh, okay. Line 1.7. This is some changes in the part about the homeowner installs, just the some clarity wording. So instead of saying that they have to be inspected before being covered in a compliance report provided, just say they have to comply with all local requirements, because they might have local requirements that are beyond that, and so that just puts it in line with local units of government. Page line 930. Okay, so that's just more of that. Okay, so now we're going to page 10. So I'm on 1.10 of the amendment. This goes to the some changes to the bonds, the common bond language. This common bond language came forth, like I said, after the bill went to the governor's office for okay. And this piece and that subdivision 2 both came from the Department of Labor and Industry relative to the plumbing program. Finally, the piece there at line 1.13, page 10, line 33, that is just parallel language to the piece that we added up at 1.3. So because there's parallel language in two places in the statute, we add the same exclusion under 3.26 there. So, I change the question.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Abel. Any questions? Okay, seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
And next we have Mr. Eric Larson. Welcome, Mr. Larson. If you could state your name for the record, please.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify. My name is Eric Larson. I live in Mille Lacs, Minnesota. I'm here representing the Minnesota On-Site Wastewater Association, or MOWA, as they're commonly referred to, a nonprofit trade association that's dedicated to education and professionalism among septic professionals. And I must say that today it's a pleasure to sit before you in support of the agency legislation. When we were here 2 years ago and last year, there were significant unsettled issues in the industry. 2 years ago, the legislature instructed the stakeholders to work it out, and it was largely unsuccessful. Last year, you provided some legislative support that became the underpinnings of a solution. The MPCA has generated a significant body of work in the last year to provide additional framework for design of septic systems under 5,000 gallons per day. Differences of opinion and interpretation of rule, guidance, and policy have arisen at times, but stakeholders have been able to work them out. There is one issue we're still discussing, and we expect to work it out also. I also would like to add a brief note about the University of Minnesota Training Program. We made reference to that, the program quality, in previous testimony. In this past year, I had occasion to attend septic conferences in multiple locations around the nation. And I can inform you that the youth program continues to be held in very high regard. It is commonly cited as a program of excellence, and by providing the knowledge needed among septic professionals, it is also significantly responsible for the success of this past year. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Larson. Any questions for Mr. Larson? Representative Cornish.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Larson, what's the one issue that you're still trying to work out, you said?
It came up late in our recent, Mr. Chairman and Representative, I'm not too familiar with this process. It came up late in our conversation, and it has to do, there is an advisory committee, the SSTS Advisory Committee, which is chartered by 115, and the body of that is established under the rule, the 78-year septic code. And it's advisory only. The last year when we were working with the agency, we meaning MOWA, and we brought We had some side issues that we negotiated with the agency, signed by Ms. Thorvig at the agency, that does add a dispute resolution process to the development of the design guidances and the prescriptive designs, which is what we've been working on to develop. And many members of the advisory committee would like to see that expanded to other issues rather than just that one. And we're in conversation with the agency on that issue. Does that answer your question, sir?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, thank you, Mr. Larson. And next, Mr. Ron Jasperson. Welcome, Mr. Jasperson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ron Jasperson, representing MOLA today. I really don't have anything to add to what Mr. Larson said, other than to thank you for the cooperation you've given us the last 2 years. The industry would be very different without your help. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Jasperson. And next we have Mr. Peter Larson. Welcome, Mr. Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Peter Larson. I'm with the law firm of Larkin, Hoffman, Daly, and Lindgren, and I'm here today representing Infiltrator Systems, Inc. You've got some materials in your packet that I'm going to refer to as we go forward. Some of you have seen this in your offices. This is the product that Infiltrator Systems, Inc. manufactures. It's the substitute for rock and pipe in a traditional drain field. We've been selling this in Minnesota for, I guess, since the early 90s. But got about 17,000 installations in Minnesota. And we're here to address one provision, and that's the warranty system provision. It actually starts on 7.32 in the bill, is actually the legislative language. And we're here to address sunset of that language. That language was put in place in 1997. It's been amended a couple times up at the legislature. It's a provision that we would really like to keep in place. It's a provision that allows counties at their discretion to allow products like this, also manufactured by a company called ADS, also manufactured in a different configuration by a company called EasyFlow, to be installed in those counties at a 40% reduction. And I don't know if you want to go into why that's an engineering possibility. From our perspective, I'd be happy to answer your questions about that. But the conclusion for us is that we think this is an important opportunity for counties who want to allow this reduction in their counties to take place. We're currently working with the PCA on another approval that would be a statewide approval. We're not here to talk to you about that today. We're happy to go through the process that they have in their rule to establish an approval that will apply statewide. I just wanted to talk a little bit about the special parts of this warranty provision, though, that we have in the counties. As part of our warranty provision, we give a 5-year warranty on these products that won't exist on a standard approval statewide. We have financial assurance at the PCA to back up that warranty. We provide information to the counties on the performance of our products. We give a lot of extra service in the counties that want to take advantage of this 40% reduction. You have in your packets, and I can just refer them to you, you have a letter in your packets from Infiltrator Systems. It's a letter dated March 16th, signed by Carl Thompson. That's my client, and he wants me to apologize to you. He's been in the state quite a bit since last October, working with the PCA on the rule issues and the approval issues we're working through. Their business is very related to the housing business. Each of these companies are very limited in their travel right now. And so Mr. Thompson would be happy to come back sometime and talk with you, but he appreciated the opportunity to submit his testimony by letter. There's another letter from EasyFlow, not my client, but a client, a company that works closely with my client, working with state regulators and getting approvals in states. There's another letter from a company called ADS, March 17, 2009. They refer to their Minnesota presence. They, if you were in this business or were around a lot of drain tile, would maybe be familiar to you. You see ADS a lot in plastic pipe. They're a huge plastic pipe company. Septic systems for them are a small part of what they do. And there's also a letter from JMK Sales, Company Incorporated. That's a distributor for EasyFlow. And what the letters essentially say is we'd like the opportunity to have local government allow this option. I've also distributed for you, and I just wanted to give you this as a perspective, Infiltrator Systems, Inc.'s approval summary. It looks like a table. It's two-sided. I colored mine. I don't think yours is colored. And this shows the approvals that are in place in different states in the country. And if you could imagine a septic system with a drain field rock component was the size of this table here, just for scale. In a lot of states, what you see is a percentage reduction of how long that septic system drain field would need to be using this product. And this is specific to Infiltrator System, my client. So you can see 48 states out of 50 allow some sort of reduction below the full-size drain field rock. And I'd be happy to answer the questions about that. In Wisconsin, anywhere in the state, you can install it at a 40% reduction. And we can talk about that a little bit more. But we would appreciate, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and we appreciate the work that Representative Poppe has done in just talking this through with us, the opportunity to keep this law in place. We think it's a good tool for local governments, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Any questions, Mr. Larson? Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Larson, what were the specific reasons given to you by the PCA for wanting to get rid of that if 48 states do it? What were the scientific or biological reasons?
Mr. Larson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish, I will give a brief answer and I'll ask the PCA to get up here. This is the issue that we're talking through with them for our state approval. I would say that for this product, there's a lot of confidence in how it's working from what we can see now. There's a little bit of concern from the agency's point of view of how it will work over a period of 30 years. And I'll let them come up with more detail on that. We've got a little bit of a difference of opinion on that, and we're working through that with them. And I guess I feel uncomfortable speaking anymore for the agency.
And did someone from the agency want to come up and address Ms. Abel?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. The issue that we're discussing is the sizing of the system. I've read through some of the letters that were submitted, and they imply that the product can no longer be sold in Minnesota or that we would impact the sale of it. What we're talking about is how much of it you need to put into a system. And so I brought along... when you build a septic system trench, it's 36 inches wide, just the yard. You fill it with rock. You put in 6 inches of rock, and then you lay the pipe on top, and you add more rock. And so you have a 36-inch wide trench. The argument they make is that these products with an outside dimension of 32 and an inside dimension of something like 26 actually should function as 36. And then they take a length reduction on top of that. And so they say that in addition to the assumed width reductions, we also should do a 40% length reduction. Now, there is science that's involved in that. When you have less space for putting the wastewater, you're going to build up the biomass sooner. It'll clog up and it'll fill up and the system won't last as long. The state has an interest in having septic systems as part of our permanent infrastructure now. And to do that, you have to build them big enough and good enough that they're going to last more than 5 years, and that's what it's about. So it's about longevity, it's about consumer protection, and we are working with them on the sizing issues. We are working with them to try to resolve it through the administrative process. And so when we seek to sunset the warranty provision, it's to allow that administrative process to play out. The administrative process in our rule goes through a process of application, review, and listing. And if they don't like how the listing comes out, there's opportunity for a contested case hearing and other legal remedies. And so it's not a one-time deal that happens. There are other things that can happen.
So, Representative Cornish has a follow-up.
I guess the natural question is what wisdom does Minnesota have versus 48 other states? And those administrative hearings you're talking about don't generally go very well for the person making the complaint, and so that's why some of these things are decided at the legislature, because they say we're going to work it out, and the parties disappear, and it doesn't always go in the favor of the complainer.
Ms. Abel.
Mr. Chair and Representative Cornish, I know how the 40% reduction came about in Minnesota. It wasn't based on science. It was based on politics. We have talked to regulators in other states, and we know that there have been similar political pressure put to have reductions. We do not believe that science supports the reductions, but we are willing and continue to talk with them about if there is reduction allowed, perhaps on the width and not the length, that we would be open to those things, but we haven't gotten to that point yet.
And
just to be open-minded about the subject. Thank you.
Okay. And I had some questions as far as how it's been working in the other states, and that has been a 40% reduction in all the other 48 states, or is that not correct? No.
Mr. Chair, if you look at the list that Mr. Larson provided to us, you see it ranges from Quebec has 100%, they don't use any at all. I assume from nothing in Quebec to a 20% reduction in South Dakota, Wisconsin, looking at our neighboring states, Wisconsin allows a 46% reduction, Iowa, 25%. So it's one of the difficulties with septic system codes is that there isn't a national code that we all use, and so looking at a list of reductions from state codes and you don't know how the state codes are written is kind of comparing soup salad and then determining that less soup salad's okay. So it's hard to know from this exactly where people are.
Yeah. Well, it looks like from the list that it's at least 20% in, mm-hmm. in the other 48 states reduction. And I was just wondering, it seems to me, I don't know how long these systems have been installed in the other states, but there would be some track record to indicate whether there has been trouble with the clogging up or the filling up, as you had raised concerns about. And I know it hasn't been is it 30 years you're maybe looking at, it hasn't been in place for that long, and that's your concern. But up until this time, they've been operating with the same rate of success as the standard sewage treatment.
Mr. Chair, the issue is how long they last. And it's been a controversial issue for quite a while. There's been a lot of studies on both sides of the issue. Well, they're scientific studies. And so they compare these to rock. They compare them to the EZ-Flow product, the other products that they have out there. And they look at the results. And the results don't clearly say that downsizing is warranted. And so we had a technical group that looked at this. The technical group did not support downsizing based on the scientific results they reviewed. There was a study done in the state of Minnesota that came to the conclusion that did not support downsizing. And so we're not seeing scientific evidence that downsizing is a scientific advantage. It's supported scientifically.
Okay. Well, and I was interested in the track record as far as the evidence we have of the systems that have already been installed. And I don't know, Mr. Larson, maybe you could testify to that as well. As far as how it has worked in the other 48 states, how long of a track record do we have to go on, both in the other states and in Minnesota? I think you were saying 97, was it in Minnesota?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Minnesota quarantine systems statute has been in place since 97. You can see on this, this table includes some dates where there are some approvals. So if you just run down here, you can see Connecticut had a 1987 approval, Georgia's 87, Kentucky's 88, Michigan's 87, New York is 87, South Carolina's 89. I just circled some of those for myself to show that there's some 20-year approvals in some pretty significant states. If ADS were here, they would describe, and the guy would have a Maine accent, which I don't have. He started working in the mid-90s on this. This was actually created first. Chambers were in Maine. And I think he traces it back to the early 70s, and they were made out of concrete. And they have a 50% reduction in Maine and have for a long time. And he will tell you that Maine is clearly watching how these systems are working, and they've had 50% reduction systems there for a very long time, 20-plus years. I think I'm underestimating, but I don't want to overestimate. On the longevity issue, I have to make a couple comments. One is the Minnesota study that was referred to specifically says that the study is not to be used as a judgment on longevity of systems. They said right in the study that this study does not draw a conclusion on that. And we understand the agency's difference of opinion, and we actually made a commitment to the agency that our statewide approval wasn't going to come up here. We're not. We told them that we were going to work it out with the agency. But there a lot of these approvals are essentially close to what's happened here in Minnesota in a way. The warranty systems went into place at the same time. These companies were going into states and wanted to have a warranty on their system. They also wanted to be downsized. They've gone back into these states and said, instead of 40 or 50%, we'd like to reduce the reduction to 20%. We'd like to remove the warranty. We'd like it to be a more regular approval. So this same discussion has taken place in a lot of places. In fact, without getting into it too much, we have those same kind of offers to the agency right now, and we're trying to find the right balance. Mm-hmm. We've gone to the agency and said, what really happened a couple months ago, or over the last couple months, is we came in with an offer of a 25% reduction, and the group said that they didn't believe that the studies that we showed them supported that. We don't agree, but they made that decision. We came back to the agency and said, okay, tell us what you'd like us to work through with you. We believe our price justify reduction. Our 25% offer was rejected. We would like to work through with you what would be acceptable to the agency. And we've talked with a bunch of you about this. We're very clear. We're not going to ask you to intervene on that. Getting back to our wish, we'd still like the counties to have this opportunity.
Okay. And let's see, Representative Bigham.
No, you answered or asked my question, Mr. Chair.
Oh, okay. And Representative Drazkowski. Okay. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. It seems to me the one thing that we could use here is some numbers or statistics. Do either one of you have any percolation rates or absorption rates as to how these systems work or don't work? Or it's kind of hard for us to sit here in judgment and say a reduction is in order when there's nothing to back up anything. Are there any numbers available?
Mr. Larson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, the way it works is that work is done, and the designer has to do that work to develop their design, and their design has to go to the county. The issue then is once they've determined the square footage that's required for the infiltration, then you get to the math of this is how big a stone rock system has to be. If it's not a warrantied system, it's the same size, but if it's a warrantied system, then you start to do some math. Some counties might say 40%, some might say 20. Some of the, my understanding, the county officials are very involved, and they might say something in between. But the work to determine the square footage that's needed for the number of bedrooms and the soil and water appliances and things like that is the same for each.
Okay. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's in that formula. Is there a safety factor or fudge factor, if you will?
Ms. Abel.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative, there is, and they're not necessarily fudge factors, because the septic system has to work on your biggest day of use. You have to build it for that biggest day and not the average day. And so there's that. And then states, so when we're comparing all these states, we were looking at Hawaii. Hawaii says for the four-bedroom home produces 800 gallons per day. We see 600. So, you know, states, when you compare states, it's not apple to apple because they build their systems differently. And so longevity studies from other states don't necessarily pertain in here. So did I answer your question, or do you want to...
Representative Purcell.
Well, Clay, I understand the divergence. I just wondered in the formulation that there is a safety factor that's built in so that you know you aren't going to have more wastewater than can be possibly be handled by the system given a four-bedroom home or whatever.
the table. We don't go for what can possibly be handled. So if you have, say, a leaky sink that discharges water a lot, you'll probably overwhelm the system. But for normal use, we say 600 gallons for a four-bedroom home, and that seems to do a very good job of curtailing it. And so if you reduce that, then, and you have a busy day, you can have some problems. So that's, we do have safety factors, but they're for most people.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think my question is for Ms. Sable. Ms. Sable, this is, if I understand, in Minnesota, aren't we currently, or would be, if we deleted page 9, line 1, it's a county-by-county system, correct? That we're not saying the county has to give a reduction. The county could decide to give a 10%, 20%, or potentially, I believe, 40% reduction. Would that be true? We're just allowing them to do that.
Mr. Chair and Representative McNamara, the way the registered products would work is that we would put out a guidance that said we believe that these products are best used like this. They can modify that in local ordinance. They can also modify it in local practice. They can issue variances, and we could say in these cases we're not going to do that. When we look at who uses warranty sizing now, there's actually not that many that do because they understand the need to have enough space for longevity. But those that do use it in cases where they don't have enough room on the lot and that kind of thing. So there will be situations where they use it and there will be time, and they can use it and they will continue to do so. It just won't have the warranted moniker on it any longer.
Well, and
Mr. Larson.
If I could, Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, our opinion is that counties will have some flexibility. They also, many of them, just look for black and white. You can use a warranty system as a reduction, you know, light. It's clear. A county that doesn't want to think about it a lot can say this is an option, and they'll have a state recommendation that will be different. And we think what they'll do is they'll mostly take the state recommendation, which again, we're working through with the agency, we're fine with that. But some counties will also, they'll be more likely to say the warranty system is still in effect, it's in the law, we know how the warranty works, there's financial assurance. They're more likely to say, and we're also going to use this option than if it doesn't exist. That's what our belief is.
And Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I'd like to see if you guys could work out the differences as this thing moves ahead. But I think, Ms. Sable, this gives some flexibility. I specifically have a constituent that has a place up north that has been working unbelievably hard for a number of years and is very close on the footage for his system. And I think, you know, if this is a system that could work for him, he's in a huge battle, I believe, with his neighbor and doesn't have the flexibility, I think, to go on the neighbor's property and such to try and accommodate the system. And he's at wit's end. So I would hope that we would keep flexibility for things like this. And so, Mr. Chair, I think, you know, based on that, I don't like to see them not in all agreement, and I hope they can get it worked out, but I think this is something that we should keep as an option as we go forward.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, can I address that?
Ms. Sable?
Our rule has several ways you can build systems. We have what we call a type 1, which we is basically the big high and dry system. We also have a type 3. And so there's someone that has the space problem to be able to use a type 3 design, which is still uses soil for treatment at higher loading rates and that kind of thing. And so the flexibility is within our rule for them to do that. They don't have to have warranties to make these changes. And they typically will.
Just an informational question, Ms. Sable. So the type 3 would never use this kind of a system then?
A type 3 system is a soil-based system that does not conform to the big high and dry standards of type 1, but still uses soil for treatment. And so a smaller one of these would be considered a type 3 if it was approved by local government.
That's the nightmare.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Sable, though, in the type 3, if it was a chambered system, would it potentially, if the county allowed a 20 or 40%, would that take up less area than a type 3 that wasn't chambered?
That's correct. I'm sorry.
Okay, so we're on the same page. That type, yeah. But I think the first one was type 1. Type 1 or type 3, both could potentially have a space saving with the chambered system.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if I could just stress it. What we tried to do with our rule was to offer lots of options for people now. So now we are also doing a registered product process for treatment products, so that they, instead of doing a mound, they could have a sand filter or something else. So we're bringing a lot more technologies in now through registered products. The vendor will support, the manufacturer will support that product and the science behind it. And then the homeowner can choose this heat filter, say, and say, I don't want the mound, I'm going to go with the peat filter and this other choice. And then you can get reduced size green field, you can get not the big pumps, but a nice, nicer looking backyard. And that's been a big change we've done in the rule, and we're just trying to keep it clean and to have everything coming through this administrative process. So there's one place for the local government to look for the information they need.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Representative Brown. Welcome, Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Brown, the interest in this bill came to me just a few hours ago, so I just want to represent a message that I got at my office from a Ben Bartow from who is an engineering manufacturer for Ring Industrial Group. And you do have my letter. His concern was that this group does produce a product that would be affected by the conversation that we were just having about line 9.1 on the House file, and their product is something called synthetic rock, and it's made out of recycled materials, which is a good thing. We do have a part of that business in Albert Lea, and so my concern, of course, would be for jobs in my community, and I would just like you to consider that, especially with the information that we just heard from the previous testifier.
Thank you, Representative Brown. Any questions at all? Seeing none, I would like to offer an amendment to address the issue that we've been discussing here. The A1 amendment, which would, on page 9, delete line 1 and remove the sunset provision. And I think this would allow for greater flexibility in allowing the counties, as Representative McNamara said, to choose the 40% reduction if they so choose. So if they deem that it's that is appropriate. Any questions or comments on the amendment? Representative Hansen.
I'd like to know what the author thinks.
Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Well, I am carrying this bill for the MPCA. This is a bill, and the reason why I'm carrying the bill is because I have straight pipe sewer problems in my district. So every year I have been carrying some sort of sewage treatment, SSTS, what is sort of the ISTS bill. So I'm carrying this one for the MPCA this time, and their desire is to keep the language in the bill. But I am well aware of my colleague here, my housemate, Representative Brown, and her issues and the issues that have been raised. So I am not going to state the position, but just so you know, that I am hearing the bill for the MPCA, and they would like the language kept as is.
Okay. Any further comments or questions? Okay, seeing none. I will renew the motion to pass the A1 amendment. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Brown. And any further, Representative Poppy, any further comments to the bill as amended?
I just to look at Ms. Sable to see if she has any final comments. Okay, no, then no, we do have a bill. It has been amended, and I would appreciate your support.
Right, and I will renew my motion that House File 1275, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Member Roosevelt.
Thank you, Representative Poppy. Moving on to, should we get the right one here? Representative, is Representative Smooth here?
Just watch out.
Is he? Yeah. Okay. Otherwise.
Like 5 minutes.
Oh, 5 minutes? Yeah. Okay. They don't know where you're Representative Gardner, I guess we'll be doing your bill first.
No, you use the trick chair, Mr. Chair. I just did two bills here and transportation.
How did they go?
Just fine.
Oh, good.
I'd rather be here. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 1372 that would be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Health Care and Human Services Policy and Oversight.
Okay. Representative Gardner moves that House File 1372 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Health Care and Human Services. Representative Gardner, to the bill.
Mr. Chair, I did have an author's amendment, but I don't know that it got to you.
Okay. Yeah, we do not have...
It's one phrase. Seek your advice. I'd hate to do an oral amendment, but I do have a couple extra copies that I got from the reviser.
How big is the amendment?
About 10 words. Is that sufficient? You'll have the written copy of it so that...
We can just make copies real quick and you can speak to the amendment.
Sure.
While they're just...
Mr. Chair, maybe I just talk broadly about the bill and then we can do the amendment once we get copies.
That would be good.
Mr. Chair, one of the largest hazards to people working in the solid waste industry is potential infection by infectious waste, specifically needles from syringes. And this has been a source of angst for a lot of the people who do the work every day to pick up your garbage or handle your waste. For those folks who have syringes at home, they usually have had the option, they should have the option of being able to put something, or they ought to put things in a rigid container so that it can be taken to an appropriate waste site, and ultimately they ought to be autoclaved to be completely disinfected. But right now we have, according to one study I've seen, more than 90% of people who have syringes at home dispose of them loose in garbage. And anytime you're handling a plastic bag, well, you have a potential for exposure there. Even if you use a laundry bottle and you're throwing it in a packer truck, it can get cracked open, and suddenly in the tip floor at the transfer station, you end up with needles everywhere. There are some alternatives that exist. I just wanted to mention some of the best practices that are mentioned by the Pollution Control Agency. I did include in your packet a flyer that lists what some of the hazards are and some of the ways you can deal with it. House File 1372 attempts to address this by essentially giving people a container when they receive more than 90 syringes at a Sharps retailer, and that is usually a pharmacy. I do have a vendor here who actually can describe it a little bit, although there are many who actually
do this work. I have the author's amendment, which actually says that a consumer may decline acceptance of that container. Some people already have a mailback program where you can send in a container with your syringes in it. Some counties, I just found out a few hours ago, Blue Earth County sent me their flyer that shows that they have a collection day, and they organize with some of the local pharmacies in the Mankato area to try and collect that material for a fee. But I don't want to have a situation where a pharmacist is chasing somebody down the aisle saying, you know, you forgot your container, I can't give it to you, or I'm going to go to jail. I don't want to create that situation. But if roughly 93% of people aren't using any sort of container and are discarding these loose, it's clear that people don't know that they can use something as simple as a laundry bottle just to keep this stuff from being loose in the garbage. And so having a container for people would be a sound idea. And so I do have a testifier here today, who's from Ultimed and here in St. Paul, who can tell you a little bit about some of the solutions we have. And if you could just introduce yourself.
Sure, I want to state your name for the case.
Mr. Chair, thank you for allowing me to speak today. I'm Tom Erickson. I'm CEO of Ultimed Incorporated, which is based in St. Paul. Ultimed manufactures insulin syringes and pen needles, which are sold by pharmacies throughout the United States and Canada. We favor the proposed legislation. There are over 2.4 billion syringes and pen needles sold by pharmacies in the United States annually. It is estimated over 30 million syringes and pen needles are sold by pharmacies every year just in the state of Minnesota. We, along with others in our industry, have been long concerned about proper needle disposal. Improperly discarded needles have caused many injuries and infections to people, particularly sanitary waste workers. Landfill operators have been especially affected. Due to the risk of dangerous infections, accidental needle stick incidents in the United States cause inconvenience, mental trauma, and tens of millions of dollars of sick leave and testing expense annually. Because of this growing nationwide accidental needle stick problem, the EPA published in December 2004 guidelines for states and local governments to follow. This right here is the EPA guideline, and what it does is it has six different alternative ways that they recommend that states can dispose of the sharp waste that's generated in the home and business environment. The EPA sharp disposal guidelines have become the new default standard for states to eventually follow. About 10 states have passed various forms of legislation and rules in an attempt to move towards conformance with the new EPA guidelines. And I'd like to emphasize moving towards. None of them have reached that point yet. And if there are questions afterwards, I can tell you briefly why. To this date, Minnesota has not changed its sharp disposal rules from those prior used to 2004. Because we manufacture these sharp devices, we have kept in close contact with the changing state and local regulations. We, along with all of the other sharps manufacturers, have been working closely with the Product Stewardship Institute on this issue. The Product Stewardship Institute is a nonprofit based out of Boston, which gets substantial funding from the EPA. 45 states, including Minnesota, are members of this organization. The safe disposal of hazardous products is a financial drain on state and local governments. Whether it's tubes and the rest of them, I'm sure this committee has dealt with a lot of these issues. The concept of product stewardship helps relieve government of this expense by requiring those who make money manufacturing or distributing hazardous products to share in the cost of disposal. At various industry meetings sponsored by the Product Stewardship Council, we have proposed syringe and needle manufacturers should supply a sharp container with each box of our products. This is an easy and low-cost way for us, I'm speaking of us in the sharps industry manufacturing these devices, to participate in a solution using shared responsibility tenets of product stewardship. It has been proven in successful disposal programs in other parts of the U.S. and Canada that simply the supply of pre-sharps container is the single most successful element to any program's success. By just supplying pre-sharps containers, the incidence of accidental needle sticks is dramatically reduced. The ultimate goal of the EPA guidelines is to remove sharp waste out of the household waste stream and into the medical waste stream. How this is to be accomplished and funded is an issue other states are trying to solve. We have a group in Minnesota, which is hosted by the Minnesota Pharmacists Association, and we have attempted to propose a solution as to how sharps waste is to be diverted into the medical waste stream. This group was unable to come up with a, what we call a complete decision in time for the current legislative session in Minnesota. To make some progress during this session, the pared down bill was introduced by Representative Gardner, which requires sharps manufacturers to supply a sharps container with each box purchase of syringes or pen needles. This bill does not provide a solution as to where people will dispose of their sharps containers. Thus, they could end up in the trash. Nevertheless, this bill is a big step in the right direction. It follows the shared responsibility concept of product stewardship. Because of this legislation is an incomplete solution, follow-on legislation will likely in future years to bring Minnesota in total compliance with new EPA guidelines. What we are proposing is similar to the situation of California's SB 1305, which became effective last September. SB 1305 is also incomplete, but it did accomplish getting California started down the right path. As time goes on, possibly even in the current session in California, it is likely California will address the remaining disposal issues and legislate add-ons to SB 1305, which will accomplish the complete disposal solution. Referring back to Minnesota, if the proposed legislation passes, all home-use syringe and pen needle units will have available to them free sharps containers, which will encourage their use. That would be a huge step forward. It would be much better than the present situation where used sharps are deposited in a host of unsatisfactory containers, or in many instances, none at all. Just having free sharps containers will greatly decrease the incidence of accidental needle sticks in Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Are there any questions? President Thiessen.
Thank you. The pharmacists, do they have a position on this bill?
Erickson.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Thiessen, I don't believe they have a position on this bill. To this point, I believe they're taking a neutral position.
President Thiessen.
We don't need to hear the bill. So you can amend your motion.
Sure.
Yeah.
And Representative Gardner, maybe you want to amend your motion, then you can just incorporate it.
Just have the bill recommend to pass and be placed in the general register.
Okay, so Representative Gardner amends his motion to have House File 1372 recommend to pass and sent to the general register.
I do have my office amendment. We can just add that in quick.
And the amendment has been handed out, so Representative Gardner.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the A090138 author's amendment.
Okay, Representative Gardner moves the A09-0138 amendment. Representative Gardner.
This just says that purchaser may decline to accept the free sharps container or free sharps disposal container. Again, as I mentioned, there are people who already have some situations set up where they've got a container that they can use. I can't imagine there would be anybody who would say I'm, you know, religiously opposed to receiving a sharps container or anything, but I think that would accept or deal with any issues of any outside vendors that aren't sharps manufacturers who may have something set up already.
Okay. Any discussion or questions? Representative Dostowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gardner, is free the right term there? I don't know that anything is free. Would it be better to say something like at no charge to the customer or something like that?
Representative Gardner?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Dreskowski, if we actually want to delete free, they could just say a purchaser may decline to accept the sharp disposal container. Sure. Would that work for you? Mr. Chair, could that be incorporated?
Believe you can just incorporate that in as a friendly amendment.
I'll accept that as a friendly amendment to delete the word free on line 1.13.
Okay. Any other discussion? Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question. Would this apply, you mentioned, obviously, for household and that, and pets, but for livestock and veterinarian sharps used on farms as well?
Representative Gardner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loon, the way the bill is written is just dealing with people who buy a box of 90. So that could be anybody. But federal law, I believe, already requires that most commercial users of Sharps, I know the dentist come by today and they said we already have to do this by federal law, so we organize with the vendor. I couldn't speak to the issue of agriculture, however.
Any other questions at all?
This just sounds like another can of worms, actually, Representative Loon, so I don't want to go there.
So, okay, seeing no other discussion, Representative Gardner renews this motion to pass the AO9-0138 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And any other, yes, any other questions or comments to the bill as amended? Okay, seeing none, Representative Gardner renews his motion that House File 1372 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Bill, motion prevails, bill is passed. Thank you, Representative Gardner. And next, Representative Coon. And I will move House File 1612 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance with the intention that it go to Environment Finance. And Representative Coon is welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 1612, I'll have a testifier, but I'll make a few comments first. House File 1612 is using some of the new parks money from the constitutional amendment to improve how visitors to our state parks use those parks by increasing the interpretive and naturalist services. So it does that in three ways. First, it creates the Minnesota Naturalist Corps, which would basically be similar to the current DNR summer internship program for summer interns with naturalists, and increase that from 18 to 30 young people involved with that program is the intent of that part of the bill. And then if you look at State Park Naturalists, it would increase our full-time naturalists by 8, and it would, with talking with the DNR, go to some of their more highly traveled, highly used parks, and then finally also improve some of the self-directed interpretive services at the parks. And I have been working with the DNR to get the numbers right, and we'll talk about that in finance, but really the intent of the bill is to use some of this new money to make sure people who aren't necessarily comfortable in parks don't necessarily know what they're doing with or don't know the plants or animals or habitats in Minnesota, to make sure they have access to resources to help them better understand and enjoy these great physical resources we have in our parks. And it also is a way to put some people to work doing that important work. And with that, I leave it over to my testifier.
Thank you. And yeah, if you can state your name for the tape, please.
Yeah, my name is Jamie McBride. I'm the president of the Minnesota Naturalist Association. It's a nonprofit professional organization of naturalists throughout the state. We have 125 to 150 members. Many are interns and many are full-time employees of different people working as professional or intern naturalists throughout the state. I happen to be employed by as a naturalist programs administrator in the Minneapolis Parks and Recreation Board. I do not represent them. I know I see our attorney over here ready to testify, I think, for the next committee, so I want to make that clear. There's a growing movement of trying to get people to get back outside and explore nature on their own, and there's research that suggests that people don't necessarily know how to do that. There was one study that I have here with me that it doesn't necessarily explain the numbers of people, but it talks about the number of kids that can identify all the Pokemon characters compared to the number of kids that can actually identify the difference between an oak and a willow, for example. And the number of kids that could identify those different animated characters that are on TV was much, much higher than those that could identify different groups. And anecdotally, I've done an exercise where I show logos of different organizations, and kids almost always can name those things off. But if we say, what's this? They'll say bird. What kind of bird? And they'll say eagle, and it's a hawk. So there's a demonstrated need for that ability. The growing movement in the country, created by a book that many people have heard of called The Last Child in the Woods, has created this national network called the Children in Nature Network. They put together a bunch of research that shows the justification for funding further programs and created partnerships all over the state. Minnesota has put together the Pollution Control Agency, and I believe St. Catherine University, put together a Minnesota report card on environmental literacy. It shows three things. First, that Minnesotans are very concerned about the environment. They're very interested in the environment. We know that by their habits, and we know that by the study that they have. The second is that they don't really know much about it, and the third is that they think they know more than they do. So that is justification there for further education in our state parks and numerous agencies, but this is about state parks, I believe. The justification is there to fund those programs. There's also another document called Greenprint, which is the state plan on environmental education. If anybody wants this, you can have it. I've got a copy. I know where to get another one. And one of the audiences for environmental education that the Green Print identifies, and this is put together by, again, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, is those that play in the outdoor recreation area, outdoor recreation resource users, I believe they call it. And they would like to use those folks, they would like to target those folks for education programs. I have a number of different highlights from the studies, if anybody is interested in hearing. I don't know how much time we have.
Yeah, we have 6 o'clock is when we're supposed to be done. So,
Mr. Chair, if we could maybe stand for questions, that would be, if that was the committee, if you would prefer to do it that way, that'd be fine.
I think that would be better, yeah. So any questions at all for Mr. McBride or Representative Knuth? Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Knuth, line 2.1, item number 2, there are ways in which exclusive bargaining representatives are to be involved in the planning and implementation of positions and job duties of persons employed by the Corps. So we have employees that are developing and defining the future positions within the organization. I've never seen that before. Can you comment on that?
Mr. Chair, can you refer to the line again? I'm sorry, I was...
2.1.
Mr. Chair and Representative Drazkowski, this basically was taken from somewhat standard language with developing this sort of program, and it's saying that representatives of the unions, I'm assuming, and we could ask our research staff as well, but it basically is that members or representatives of the union are involved in helping to define who's in the Corps. I mean, it's basically the They're state employees as well, and so it's just making sure a certain set of state employees is involved with this.
Okay. Any further questions? Representative Lewin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Knuth, just to make sure I understand the purpose, this would create an internship program. So are we largely talking about college students or post-college? And for what period of time would you envision this? This kind of for short-term positions, longer-term?
Mr. Chair, the DNR already currently has an internship program. It's basically for the summer, which is when our parks are more heavily used. It's when college students have time to have employment. So it would be increasing that. When I'm looking at some documentation from the DNR, they think they could increase their capacity from about 18 interns currently to 30, and it's making it a more, kind of giving it a more formal program, making sure that Minnesotans know that this is one of the things that their constitutional amendment has helped pay for, and it provides a useful job opportunity for people in their college years. It's not meant to displace current state employees or be a long-term employment, and in talking to the DNR, they get way more applications and they're able to fill jobs for these sorts of things, so there's a demand for it as well as something young people want to do for work for the summer.
Okay, and Representative Duskowski, did you have...
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Canuso, are these all volunteer positions? Are some of them paid, or...
Mr. Chair, Representative Duskowski, the internship program is a paid program currently, and I would expect it to be our young people are paying more in college costs, and I think a paid summer internship is a great way to get some job experience and be able to pay for their schooling.
Representative Duskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Knuth, back to my other question at 2.1, the unions are going to be determining who is hired, which positions are defined within the organization, the job duties of positions and maybe individuals. Does that include is the management in the union at this point, or it seems to me that management should be defining these positions rather than people who are not in management.
Mr. Chair, Representative Duskowski, I think it's different levels of management, and I'm not an expert on who's in what unions in our state agencies. I think people appointed by the governor would not be, but managers, upper level managers would be in. I think my understanding is they would be. They're management level.
Okay. So Representative Duskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Representative Knuth, is there a functional reason, as you look at the bill and the organization and what it's to accomplish, is there a reason that needs to be in there, the 2.1 and 2.2 lines, number 2?
Mr. Chair, Representative Duskowski, I think we want to make sure there's probably comfort with the unions that they're not displaced. I mean, that language is also part of the Subdivision 7 with the employee displacement, but I think to make sure that union representatives are involved in that conversation and to make sure that that's not happening, I think would be an important part of making this program work well.
I think Representative Cornish is next.
Chair members, yeah, when looking at the entirety of the bill, it looks like the unions have already been involved in the bill quite heavily. In other words, the planning where these positions are going to be used, it looks like they're protecting the union from displacement, because you look down at lines 2.22, technically the union, the core members aren't going to be employees of the state within the meaning of 43 of the employment law. So, and then they talk about employee displacement. It looks like the involvement of the unions in the bill is to make sure that if you hire these core members, they're not going to take union positions away, and they're not going to be technical state employees, and they're not going to have certain benefits. So it looks like the reason for them up on the top of the page, the reason that they're there, all right. So.
And Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Representative Cornish just answered my question. The comment that I had. So.
Okay. And Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And Representative, again, along those same lines, could you ever envision a scenario where, because this is a different funding stream to pay for these naturalists, we could be hiring them at the same time that we're laying off DNR employees because of budget problems?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I think that's a conversation we'll be having in the Environment Finance Committee, and I think it is one of the difficulties of the supplementing versus supplanting conversation with the constitutional amendment intentionally want to be using this constitutional amendment money in a way that improves how people access parks and also contributes to employment in useful ways. And so I think we will have that conversation in the Environment Finance Committee. And I know that naturalists have been an area that have been cut when we've been in previous budget deficits, and I think there's a definite capacity to be filled, and I'm hoping we can do that this year.
And Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, what was the motion for this?
It is to be referred to the Finance Committee, so those issues will be raised there.
So Finance could deal with Finance.
Right. Any other questions? Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Knuth, I'm wondering if the Parks and Trails Council or the DNR has weighed in on how they're feeling about this bill.
Mr. Chair, I have not gotten the DNR to support it. I think we have a representative from Parks and Trails. I mean, I've had conversations with them. I didn't just pull these numbers out of a hat or say that this is the capacity they could use. This comes from information they provided the Environment Finance Committee, and I've been having conversations with them along the way in developing the bill.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Knuth, did the Parks and Trails Council or the DNR ask you to carry the bill, or is it your idea?
Representative Knuth.
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, it's an idea that was kind of being batted around in different members of Environment Finance, and I think it's a really good idea and a good use of the money, and so that's where it came from. And if the Parks and Trails people want to comment, they're here.
Okay. Welcome, Ms. Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Judy Erickson. I'm with the Parks and Trails Council of Minnesota. And the bill that Representative Knuth has before you today is something that we support. Naturalist programming is an issue that we've been concerned about for a long time in our state parks and trails. And the bill that was pulled from the agenda today, House File 1493, did have very similar language, a little bit different approach to naturalist programming, but it is one of the three areas that we would like to see additional funding for. A lot of the new money is for naturalist programming. There are only 8 full-time naturalists in our state park system today, and I think there's about 18 internships provided currently. And if we're looking at ways to connect people to the out of doors, we need naturalist programming. We need people there teaching and showing and educating and helping people understand our great outdoor system here in Minnesota. So we do support the legislation.
Thank you. Any other? Anyone else? Any other questions or any other testimony? Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, I don't really have any problem with this bill, but I think one thing that everybody should be aware of is that this amendment money is going to be used to hire additional people. The thing I like about the bill is they're not eligible for unemployment benefits and they don't displace regular workers, but we are going to be loading on a lot of employees when this whole session is done. And that's what my worry is that the whole area of this amendment money being used is that, you know, the DNR has wanted to hire these employees, obviously, for years. Now they've got the chance to hire them, but with amendment money. And so I just want to make sure they're not real employees that we're going to have to take care of after a certain amount of time. So I'm hoping that each one of these bills comes through, we aren't establishing a cliff for us. So if amendment money runs out, or if we start spending all the money on salaries, it's going to have to come every year after year after year. Then once all this amendment money is used just like a budget, there isn't going to be any extras anymore for this, and this. So just got to think this through really well, I think. But it kind of looks like the CCC Corps that of the old days when they built parks, you know, the way of putting some people to work and getting some things done. So I don't have a big problem, but just so we don't make we drop off the cliff with no more money after a while.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish, a good conversation to be had in the Environment Finance Committee.
Any other comments or questions? Okay. I see none, so I will renew the motion that House File 1612 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance with the intention that it go to Environment Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevailed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So it's passed. And we are just going to do one more thing. We're done with the bills, but we are going to have some testimony, very brief testimony, on the critical areas. Critical areas. This is a report on a report. Mr. Lockesville?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. Director Ken Lockesville, I'm the Director of the Division of Water at the DNR. And this topic, there was a, let me explain, the Mississippi critical area is that corridor that's 72 miles through, essentially through the Twin Cities, from Ramsey and Dayton down to Hastings, or just past Hastings. This last 2 years ago, in 2007, the legislature required that the DNR prepare a report looking at the state of the Mississippi River critical area. This the critical area was formed about 30 years ago, and it's managed through an executive order, 7919. So this isn't managed like Shoreland and Wild and Scenic Rivers, which have a set of promulgated rules. This is a little bit different situation where it is an executive order, and there are ordinances that local governments administer. This affects about 30 local governments. So the enabling statutes for this are in the EQB's section of law, 116B, and DNR's typical section of law is 103F, is where our land use programs are. So we conducted a survey of the corridor communities, the 30 communities, and then also under contract we did some stakeholder group meetings, and that was through, we contracted with the Friends of the Mississippi River and also a consultant to conduct those surveys. These stakeholders and our surveys identified a number of strengths and weaknesses of the current program, and they discussed a variety of options for the program change. There's pretty much unanimous support that the critical area designation should remain, and they generally wanted to see the program strengthened with more staff and funding and more specific management goals. So the report, which if you want the entire report, 170 some pages, it is posted on our website, so that's available if people wish to get it there. We do have some paper copies if people wish to request those. We have some, but we didn't print many of these. But the report does identify over 30 options for changing the Mississippi River critical area management. And those options were grouped into four major categories. Options that move the corridor administration. It's currently administered by DNR. In the 70s, it was administered by EQB. There's options also for enhancements within the existing program. Options identified that modify the current program processes, and also options that increase the oversight of local decisions. So the stakeholders pretty much unanimously supported options for enhancing the existing program, and there were mixed support between the various groups for the options that involve substantial changes to the program and or our authorities. So some of these options obviously could be implemented with relatively minor funding and staffing changes. Others, like rulemaking, take longer and more money to actually implement. So, you know, very quickly, that's a real quick summary of what we looked at. We, you know, it was an evaluation that hadn't been done in quite some time. So, you know, we followed the legislative direction and developed that. What hasn't happened since this report was finished in January of 2008. Is there were discussions about next steps, and some of those discussions then resulted in a building introduced by Representative Hansen, and those options then are under discussion as that bill moves through the process. So I can answer other questions, and there are other staff here if there's specific things that I can't answer.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Lockesmo, and yes, Representative Hansen does have a bill that's moving forward that we will be hearing on next Tuesday. To deal with this very issue, which is why we're doing this short report right now. And Representative Cornish, you had a question?
Just a comment, Mr. Chair. I read through the bill, and I got a call from my sister, actually, who lives on the edge of the river, and she was quite scared by the bill, and they heard what's going to be heard today, and there's a bunch of people calling.
the question is, I'll make a general statement and see if you agree with it or disagree. The bill seems to be really a burdensome bill, or how should I term it? It's not just a simple bill where recertification of the old program, it's a renaming, but it looks like a lot of authority is usurped by the state, and it looks like local governments, if they're going to have any plans, have to be forwarded for approval before they enact the plans within so many days, and a lot of different regulations, and it seems like local authority taken away, and I'm wondering if you consider this the landowners the stakeholder, because a lot of landowners were calling back and forth really worried about this bill, and they were calling me, and I just got the Blue Earth River, I don't have the Mississippi, but like I say, they started calling me and asking me questions, but it doesn't seem just to be a simple bill. I could see Representative Hansen's fingerprints when it started talking about slopes of bluffs. I remember the Bull Ditch episode when he went there, and the steep slopes and very steep slopes and bluff spaces and things like this. So it looks like a really complex bill that we have to pay attention to.
Well, and just to mention, we are going to be hearing the bill on Tuesday, and I don't know what, you know, changes may occur between now and then as far as the bill language is concerned, too. So I think it's a little premature maybe to be talking about the bill today. It's one of the reasons that it was put on hold. So today we just wanted a brief report on the critical area reports that have been done. So a little bit of background information before we hear the bill. And I don't know if Representative Hansen, you had some comments?
I would encourage folks to look at the report, the whole report. And this is complex. It's a 30-year-old executive order. It is very detailed. And so that's why we asked for the report. That's why I asked for the report to be presented today, because it's been on the shelf for about a year. And, you know, when we actually take up the bill, I think it'd be good to kind of learn the acronyms and the language that's in the report. Because it's old executive order, 30 years old, and I think it'd be valuable to look at that. I did have one question for Mr. Vaca from Los Angeles. When you did the survey of the local units of government, about 22 responded, and one of the questions is related to variances, and it says here that a total of 230 applications were received. That's reported from those 22 out of 30 communities, of which 200 were approved and 30 were denied. Can you maybe just talk a little bit about the methodology there? I mean, that doesn't seem over a period of time, 30 years, to be that many variances being sent to the DNR for review.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, you're right that over that period of time, that seems like a relatively small number of variances. I know some communities may have tracked things differently and not counted them as variances. And when you look at the number, the way the reporting was done, you don't know whether or not a variance that was granted was for a 2-foot setback variance or a, you know, 85-foot setback variance, or what mitigation went into approving that variance. So it just gives you an idea of the overall number, but it's difficult to draw conclusions whether or not the communities were doing a good job in the administration and approving those variances, or a bad job, without knowing the specific details on each application.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Cornish.
Just a quick one, Representative Eakin. Representative Hansen, when you do present the bill, would it be possible for you to have a side-by-side what was the old bill and maybe the reasons why people are requesting variances, and what will be the regulation of it, so we can get an idea how much it's going to change versus the old bill?
We have that, so I will bring that.
Okay. Any other questions or comments on the report? Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Hansen, will we, I'm assuming, if we look at the full report, it identifies the 17 communities that did participate, or Mr. Lockersmall. I'm just wondering, like, did St. Paul, were they one of the 17? I'm wondering if it's, and I'm assuming, would the full report show that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McNamara, the full report does show that, and I'd have to dig through it and find the answer. I don't know it off the top of my head.
Any other questions? We do have one person that would like to testify. Is there if you could do so briefly, that'd be great. And if you could state your name for the record, please.
My name is Nick Tiedekin. I'm a river property owner in Brooklyn Park. I've got a house there, and we've got a bunch of neighbors, and we're the ones that are quite concerned about House File 424, and we'll be back in next week to talk a little bit about that. But the thing I wanted to talk about with this report is the stakeholder involvement process. And one of the things that we find lacking in the report is really a reaching out to the businesses or the residents that live within the corridor. For instance, if we look at the business invitations that went out, it's the Minnesota Historical Society, Prospect Park, East River Road Association, Sierra Club, North Star Chapter, these are the businesses and developments now, Friends of the Riverfront, MCEA, Carpenter Nature Center, State Historic Preservation, Hastings Environmental Protectors, Sierra Club again, Mississippi River Trust, Trust for the Public Land, Urban Boat Builders, that's about the only business I saw on the business invitation list. And I didn't see any of our North Suburban area residents or organizations invited to the stakeholder process. So we feel really left out, and I don't know if that list was a mistake, and Mr. Lockersmoke can correct that, but the Sierra Club really isn't a business. Like, we have a business on the river, it's called Kenner Canoeing. It's been in operation for 45 years, and anybody that's done any canoeing in Minnesota is familiar with that operation. They know the river as well as any business in this state. He knows the river better than any resident in the state, and he wasn't involved in the stakeholder process, and that's extremely disappointing. And so we, based on that lack of our involvement, we're going to have some comments next week. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
I know Mike.
Any other comments or questions? Okay, Representative McNamara.
Well, just a follow-up to the testifiers. Mr. Lockersmoke, what was 3M, Flint Hills, or any of the other industrial ConAgra's land does go back to the river in my area? Do you know if any of them were invited? Because I know they all have river shore and potentially could be impacted by this potential legislation.
Mr.
Chairman and Mr. McNamara, I believe they were. What we did on the stakeholder involvement is we contracted with the Friends of the Mississippi River and the consultants, and Irene Jones could maybe quickly answer that question on if those, well, were those invited?
There wasn't. Welcome, Ms. Jones. You can state your name for the record.
Okay. Good evening. Start weekend. My name is Irene Jones. I'm with Friends of the Mississippi River based in St. Paul. Just looking at the list that you were referring to, I just realized that for some reason the citizen and environmental group got listed twice in the report. I do have, and I think the DNR probably has, the list that was originally done in the report that we submitted to them, and if people want, I actually have it on my computer. I could read them off as to who we invited. But that list that just got read, and I apologize that I didn't notice that that error had been made, was the list of citizens that got printed twice. If you look at the list of environmental and civic groups in the report, you'll see the exact same list. So there was a different list of river businesses. Friends of the Mississippi River did reach out to many river businesses. We reached out to developers and CDCs in the corridor, and we did have a group of stakeholders that came to a meeting and provided input on the critical area program.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, we can provide that list for your next hearing. That
would be helpful. Okay. Any other questions? Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I apologize, I missed your name, but if you could get to Mr. Lockersmoke electronically, is it possible you could post it in the same spot? Or do you just want to bring it? I wouldn't mind seeing it beforehand. If I could get it, I'd like to see, because my district is in the area, and I'd like to see. So if you can get it to the DNR, if we can get an electronic copy or something prior to the day the bill's heard.
And Mr. Kudelka said if sent to him, he could get it off to all the members of the committee. So, Mr. Lockersmoke.
Mr. Chairman, we can provide an electronic one to Mr. Kudelka.
Okay. Any other comments? Okay. Seeing none, meeting is adjourned.